A Minnesota jury last week acquitted a police officer in the shooting death of Philando Castile. Castile's death sparked protests in Minnesota and elsewhere, especially as video of the shooting was broadcast by Castile's girlfriend as she sat next to him as he died.
The acquittal of police officer Geronimo Yanez came as a surprise to some, given the video evidence of the incident, and could potentially further the divide between law enforcement and minority communities.
Kemi Chavis joins us now. She's a professor of law and director of the Criminal Justice Program at Wake Forest University School of Law. She's a former prosecutor as well. Kemi, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
So what was your reaction when you heard about the acquittal?
Well, when I heard about the acquittal of Officer Yanez, I was surprised because we all saw, millions of Americans saw the live Facebook streaming that Diamond Reynolds did during the shooting. And to me, it was very egregious. I thought, this is really egregious. He's telling you that he has a weapon, like he's licensed to carry this weapon. And Philando Castile, the victim here, really did everything he was supposed to do. And the fact that Diamond Reynolds and her young daughter were also in the car and were endangered by this officer's behavior was very troubling as well. So I say that I'm surprised in that sense, but in some ways, I'm not, because we know that these cases are very difficult.
And friends and family of Philando Castile were distraught over the news of the acquittal. Here's his mother speaking after the ruling came down.
My son loved this city, and this city killed my son. And the murderer gets away. Are you kidding me right now?
So, Kemi, of course, every case is different, but how do communities in general cope with cases like this when there is an acquittal of the police officer?
Yeah, you know, this is, again, it's very troubling, and many communities, unfortunately, have dealt with this historically. You know, we have, over the last maybe 4 or 5 years, been more attuned to some of the things that are happening because of social media and cell phones. We are, as the general public, we are more likely to see these cases and recognize them, but realize that a lot of this has been happening. I think what's really troubling for communities is we're saying, well, we have, now we have body camera footage, cell phone footage, we have these things, and it's still very difficult for officers in this case. And again, not every case will be deemed an unjustified shooting. There are times when officers, when you're giving the facts surrounding the case reasonably, act reasonably. I just think that many times communities are seeing that often there's nothing else, again, that Mr. Castile could have done to allay the officer's fears. And he's lost his life because of that.
And as we heard, Valerie Castile feels that her son was murdered, and Geronimo Yanez, the officer, was charged with manslaughter in the shooting, not murder. Why would a choice be made to go for manslaughter in a case like this?
Yes, well, when we're thinking about the criminal law, and there are different types of homicides, murder being the most serious type of homicide. But manslaughter, again, very serious charge, and I don't have the statute in front of me, but when we're thinking about manslaughter, it could be based on some type of recklessness or negligence rather than, an intent to kill, or a depraved indifference, which usually would be a higher, the more serious charged with murder. And so I have to say, we've gone different increments when thinking about these arguments. First, the argument is, well, these officers aren't charged at all. And I think, again, because of the attention a lot of these cases are getting, we're starting to see officers charged, but we can kind of tick through, 5 or 6 cases where officers recent cases where officers have been charged, their cases have been, they've gone to trial, and they've been acquitted, or the jury has deadlocked, as you may recall in the Walter Scott case, which was another case caught on videotape, very egregious shooting. The suspect is seen running away, and the jury could not come to a decision in that case. So bringing the charges is one thing, but really being able to secure a conviction is quite another.
And of course, it's difficult not being in the jury room as they deliberate, but what do you think might have led the jury in this case to acquit Officer Yanez in the killing of Philando Castile?
Yes, and I'm glad that you said that, because we, you know, as disappointed as I am, and as I think as many others are in this verdict, we were not in that room. And again, you know, they're weighing the evidence. They're seeing far. A lot of us saw that the Facebook post, but again, they were privy to all types of testimony. So I would not want to speculate as to what they were thinking, but one thing that we know in these cases is that if the officer was in reasonable fear for the officer's safety or life, then that carries a lot of weight in terms of whether or not that officer was justified in using force. And the hard truth of that is that it is very easy and often it could be true, but many times, you know, if an officer tells a jury, I was afraid for my life, in my mind, this is what was going on. This was a rapidly unfolding situation. And so my concern is that this case sends two troubling messages. And one message is that, you know, police officers, you know, it's very easy to say that, even though that may not have been the case, or that may not, or it should not have been the case. That's one message it sends for officers. Okay, we say that, and then we're, you know, not going to be held accountable. And another message that it sends is to the community that quite frankly, these, you know, lives don't matter.
We're talking with Cami Chavis right now. She's a professor of law and director of the Criminal Justice Program at Wake Forest University School of Law. She's with us to talk about the recent acquittal of the officer in the Philando Castile shooting, law enforcement, and what can be done to mend relations between police departments and minority communities.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What was your reaction to that acquittal this weekend? More generally, what do you think law enforcement should do to prevent these kind of shootings? What can communities and police departments do to maybe allay some of the tension, some of the perceived mutual threats they see in each other? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our conversation about the acquittal of the police officer who shot and killed Philando Castile last year during a traffic stop. We're talking to Cami Chavis. She's a professor of law and director of the Criminal Justice Program at Wake Forest University School of Law.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think of the ruling in this case, the acquittal of the police officer in the case? What do you think law enforcement should do to try to avoid these situations? What can be done to build better connections between minority communities in particular and police departments? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
So, Cami, on the heels of the ruling in the Philando Castile case this weekend, a young pregnant mother in Seattle named Charlena Lyles was shot and killed by police when she called to report a burglary. What do we know about what happened there?
So my understanding is that officers had been to Mrs. Lyles' home before on other calls, and she had at one point wielded scissors or something like that, and then they're called back to the home because she is reporting a burglary. So she is, you know, saying that she is the victim of a crime, and from what I understand, at least what the officers are saying. And again, what's important is that we only have really the officers' accounts here and what can be heard on the audio that's been made available. But once, they were in the home, they were kind of saying that these are the things that look like they're missing. And then the officers reported that, you know, she was holding a knife. Now, my understanding is that two officers, typically when a citizen has made a call like this, you'll send one officer out because of those previous calls to her home and what officers had experienced previously. Two officers were sent to the home. But again, this is a case that makes me, there are a few things that I think about when looking at this case, because Ms. Lyles, according to her father, I think was 90 pounds. There were at least three to four other children in the house, and there are two officers there. And so, and neither of them, I believe, I'm not sure, but at least one of the officers is saying he didn't have a taser, mm-hmm. so he didn't have, even if the officers were threatened, physically threatened in that case, they didn't have, according to them, less than lethal alternatives. And I do believe that as we begin to think about solutions to this, that we really need to think about less than lethal alternatives, particularly in the case here where there's some suggestion that she may have had some mental health issues.
My understanding is that on the audio, one officer says, tase her, and the other one says, I don't have a taser, and that, in fact, the Seattle police offer as non-lethal tools to officers the choice of a taser, a billy club, or pepper spray. So why do you think non-lethal weapons, non-lethal tools are not used more often in order to subdue people?
Well, when from the viewpoint of a law enforcement officer, so what I have heard many law enforcement officers say is that, well, if you are, and of course, and this is true from a legal standard, if you are threatened with deadly force, then an appropriate response can be deadly force. I think that a lot of times in these cases, you know, again, we think about, okay, this is a, if these were not two police officers and this was, you know, a 90-pound woman with a knife and two other individuals that were standing there, you know, would the use of a gun have been considered excessive force, right, if they were trying to, you know, defend themselves? So I'm kind of thinking about it from that standpoint. But officers, you know, you are allowed to respond with deadly force if you are facing deadly force. The issue, and that's from a legal legal standard, but I think as we again kind of explore solutions, there have been many instances we need to think about. Well, why are officers often very quick and sometimes can make mistakes, right? With respect to, okay, I'm you've asked me for my driver's license, I'm going to pull it out of my pocket, but now all of a sudden you think that I'm going for a weapon. I mean, so there we really need to think about the use of first of all, non-lethal uses of force, like what you mentioned, tasers, billy clubs, pepper spray, are some issues that are still very dangerous and can harm people, but can also save lives and protect officers. And then we need to think about de-escalating. How does a woman end up dead because she called officers for help? And there's been several other cases, the last case in Oklahoma, that officer was also acquitted, where, you know, the motorist is stranded in the middle of the highway, and immediately, instead of thinking this might be a person who needs help, this is a person who is a threat.
Let's go to our phones, and Quincy in Melrose is up first. Hi, Quincy.
How are you?
Good.
I guess, well, a lot of it, we used to call it, it's kind of like almost being in a circular firing squad. We get images of we African-American people being violent, and it's portrayed over and over and over. And my personal idea or belief is, as soon as the person identified, I have a gun, everything else ceased, and he felt he was threatened. And then you get the bad result. And I've lived through the 60s all the way up to today. So I've seen this over and over. It's a pattern. It's pervasive. And a lot of it has to do with what seeing. And if we keep showing people as criminals, thugs, all this, this is what they're going to think we are.
All right, Quincy, I want to give Cammy a chance to respond there. So Quincy's saying we don't know each other and we get these images of other communities and we don't have a hope of really connecting.
Yeah, well, I think what Quincy has touched on is really this very serious issue of implicit racial bias. And this is something that, you know, a lot of research around. But, you know, I'm not sure that this issue of implicit racial bias came up in or that it has come up in many of the cases that we've seen. But certainly in the Philando Castile case, I mean, this is he's legally licensed to carry a weapon. Officers are trained on how to deal with suspects who may be carrying. So and it's not, and the response is not to open fire on that person, particularly when you have two very innocent bystanders, you know, right or in very close proximity. So this issue of implicit racial bias, it is real. And I say implicit, I mean, we talk a lot about implicit racial bias. That's not to say that explicit racial bias doesn't come into play. But, you know, we know that the black male stereotypes or stereotypes of people of color and particularly black males are really rampant in our media, just like your caller mentioned, and it can have a very negative effect.
Quincy, thanks for that call, and we'll go next to Zolland in Green Bay. Zolland, thanks for calling.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. I had a general comment. My brother-in-law's from Afghanistan, and he was a police officer there. And when he came here recently, we talked about, you know, we were listening to the news, and I would tell him the stories about all these police shootings. And he was just baffled. He was always shocked at how these people were dying and why they were dying. And it seemed like their deaths weren't justified. So I guess I wanted to just say, share that, you know, a person from, you know, that was a police officer in the middle of a war zone, their police etiquette was different. You know, they have real risks there. They have suicide bombers that they have to look out for and assess. But even there, they weren't as trigger happy. They were careful to pull out their guns and point. So I just wanted to make a comment about that, how big of a difference that is, the irony of it. And so that was just my comment.
Zolland, thanks so much for those thoughts. And Cammy, is there something of a culture here that where this type of violence seems to happen fairly frequently?
Yes, there is. There is a cultural aspect to it. And what your caller shared is very striking. But when we think back about, police culture, I think of it as kind of characterized by three things. We have group loyalty, right? Police officers, they need to be loyal to one another because they're going to be in situations where they need to protect each other. So there's a fierce group loyalty, which sometimes can have a perverse nature. If you see someone doing something wrong, if you see another officer doing something wrong, you may be less likely to say something. There's also the idea that violence is necessary or that some level of aggression is necessary to promote public safety. And I don't believe that that's true. The two promoting public safety and partnering with promoting public safety and having police accountability are not mutually exclusive. But the third characteristic of police culture in the United States is the kind of a lack of supervision and training. We know that in many cases there have been cases where officers have exhibited a pattern, individual officers have exhibited a pattern of behavior, but they've been, allowed to stay on the police force or promoted or even left there to train other officers. And so we do need to look at police culture, a lot of which, and what I described, I think that a lot of that folks recognize that was the culture, and there have been many attempts to change it, but we're not quite there yet. We haven't waded through all of those issues to really come to an appropriate policy solution.
Thanks so much for that call, Zolland. And Cammie, as we start wrapping up here, I'm struck by the fact that in both of these cases, in Seattle, where the victim called the police herself to report a crime, and in Minnesota, where Philando Castile told the police officers, "I have a gun, it's a legal gun," they did what was right. They did what they were told was the correct thing to do, and yet both of them ended up dead. And so how do police officers and law enforcement agencies build those relationships, especially with minority communities?
Right. And this is very important. What I was saying earlier about promoting public safety and keeping police accountable, we can do both, that they're not mutually exclusive. We don't have to resort always to violence and death of people that we're trying to, that we should be trying to protect and serve. And so it's very damaging, though, to the community relationships. And I think that there are a lot, and I do want to say that I believe that the vast majority of police officers are professionals and are doing a difficult job the best way they can, often without adequate training, training, screening, all of those things. So that's another side of this equation that we need to think about in terms of officer morale.
And we'll have to leave it there, Cammie. Thanks so much for joining us today. Cammie Chavis is a professor of law and director of the Criminal Justice Program at Wake Forest University School of Law.